Okay. I like to think that this follows on very much from what Steve was saying. And of course, the title of the project is Accommodating Conscience, but I'm going to talk about curtailing conscience, the other side of the coin. And I suppose to say, let's not forget about that. And I'd agree with Steve that conscience isn't just about refusing to do things. Conscience is involved in decisions to act positively. And what I'm going to do, or what I want to do, is look at the law's effect on claims of conscience in particular, or to be more precise, the law's move towards a prioritization of patient autonomy and its effect on conscience. And I'm going to do that in the context, or look at that in the context of the provision of experimental or innovative medical treatments, in particular, right to try laws in the US. I gave a paper at a workshop in London that the Edinburgh lot were at, so feel free to fall asleep at that point, if not before, guys. And my argument is that perhaps paradoxically, the law's empower, or the law seeking to empower patients, doesn't limit claims of conscience by doctors, but actually helps to reinforce them while removing protections that we might expect to exist for patients. But I'll get to that in a moment. To see where I'm coming from, I wrote a paper a few years ago that looked at claims of conscience at the beginning, and I had two requirements for a claim to be called a claim of conscience. I said, first of all, it must not be based on a professional judgment, or as I would call it, technical medical skill, as Steve alluded to. Essentially, it should involve values, or it must involve values. And I got this basically from Ian Kennedy. Ian Kennedy's argument was always that if the issue isn't one of technical medical skill, then it is problematic if we allow the doctor's values to prevail, we should allow the patient's values to prevail. So his argument was always, well, let's change the law to prioritize patient autonomy, that solves the problem, ta-da, let's all go home. I also said that a claim of conscience must involve exercising choice. And the reason I said that was because then we are talking about a doctor reflecting on those values. And I felt that reflection was important. And I thought to myself, who could possibly disagree with that? Stephen Smith could possibly disagree with that in a paper helpfully provided for all. So Steve has gone through this already, but so I'll only make a couple of points. I mean, he criticized, he commented on both of my criteria and added a third. In relation to the professional judgment aspect, he said that it's not enough for the claim of conscience to be based on values. It must be based on moral or ethical values. And I state that because I think it becomes more important later on. He gave an example. He said if a doctor chooses whether to wear blue or green scrubs that day, that decision may be based on their aesthetic values. And that's not really what we're talking about when we're talking about claims of conscience. He says that a claim of conscience doesn't have to belong, the decision maker doesn't have to belong to a moral or ethical tradition, or even a religious tradition, but the issue needs to be moral or ethical in character. He also said that there's no need for options, only authorship. I'd take slight issue with him on that, perhaps, but I'm not going to quibble. And then finally, as he said, the decision must be inward-looking. In other words, it's a doctor saying, I will do this or I will not do this, rather than I would prefer it if you didn't do this or if you did do this. Now, there's plenty of sense there, and I'm not going to argue about which definition is better, not least because his is far more elegant and I may get to an answer that I don't like. But what I want to do is look at, I want to make an argument that the provision of experimental or innovative treatments actually meets both of those criteria in relation to claims of conscience. They are, in both cases, doctors applying values in order to help them make the decision. I think here we get to Steve's four other criteria. So, three examples of innovative treatments being provided, let's just say with varying levels of success, or what we'd consider varying levels of moral acceptability. Sims and Sims, we all know, experimental treatment provided to victims of new variant CJD. Paolo Macchiarini, for different reasons, we all know, synthetic tracheas, research fraud, not a nice man. Medical Board of Australia and Boyd is a case that I'm assuming less people may be aware of. It's an Australian, I think it started off as a fitness to practice case, and you'll see why. This is about a doctor who provided alternative therapies to cancer patients. Unfortunately, the concoction that the patients were use the word treated with loosely, was toxic. So after 4 weeks, 7 patients were treated. After 2 weeks, 4 of the patients had died. A further patient died after 6 weeks. A sixth patient died after 9 weeks. And the only survivor was a patient who stopped the treatment after 11 days because they felt that it was doing more harm than good. And they lived for a further 4.5 years. Now, I would argue that these cases are very different. We've got fraud, we've got a doctor doing spectacularly bad doctoring, and we've got, in Sims and Sims, a decision to provide treatments that most of us would probably agree with. And I would argue that all three of those, at least in part, involve a claim of conscience. There is, of course, as Steve alluded to, the exercise of clinical judgment to begin with. Does the treatment that is proposed relate to the condition that the patient has? What does the doctor assess the chances of success as being, etc., etc.? I know that there are medics in the room, you know. But there are also value judgments. Is the level of perceived risk acceptable? Is the risk, how do we balance, or when we balance the risk to the patient against the potential benefits, do we think that they are worth it? If we balance the risk to that patient against the potential benefits to future patients, does that affect our decision to provide the treatment? And I think we can all agree that we support the decision to provide the therapy in Sims and Sims, but disagree with the decisions by Boyd and Macchiarini. And this means that when we're talking about claims of conscience, we don't mean that we simply allow doctors to make any decision that they like. What we mean is that we want to support claims that are based on good values, not just values. We want to support Sims and Sims. We don't want to support Boyd or Macchiarini. And this then also means that we don't just want to stop the dodgy, like Macchiarini. We also want to stop the overconfident, the reckless, those who put their own potential glory before the welfare of their patients, those who perhaps place too much emphasis on the potential value to future patients of a significant risk to be undertaken by current patients. And normally, we would expect that the law and regulators would do this job. That if doctors like Boyd and Macchiarini did what they do, that either the law would punish them or the regulator would punish them, or frankly, both. But perhaps paradoxically, the laws move towards increased protection or prioritization of patient autonomy risks undermining that, and a very, very good example of that is right to try laws in the US. Now, I'm going to use the right to try law example because I think it's an excellent example. There was a failed attempt to create the same thing here through Lord Saatchi's medical innovation bill. And at this point, I should declare an interest. I was a long-standing member of a group called Stop the Saatchi Bill that campaigned against that potential law. And so I'll talk about mainly right to try. I do have a couple of quotes from the Saatchi debate. And then I'll move on to Montgomery because, you know, we're in Scotland. So what is right to try? They're known as Dallas Buyers Club laws. And to give you a potted description, it's legislation created by the right-wing libertarian Goldwater Institute in the US. They value free markets. They value minimal government interference. And so they have this model legislation that they've encouraged states to either adopt in full or tweak slightly and then adopt in slightly modified form. So far, 38 states have passed the legislation. There's also a federal version, which passed the US Senate last year, and the House of Representatives has just passed its own version last week. So this is going to become federal law. So, and essentially, it is sold as giving patients rights to access drugs that they would not normally be able to access. So if they meet the qualifying criteria, any drug that has passed phase one testing can be provided without any of the FDA's regulatory requirements being met. So what are these qualifying requirements? Right. The patient must be terminally ill and unable to get to a clinical trial. This interests us. The physician must recommend the treatment. In other words, the physician must make one of these value judgments that says, I want the patient to have this. The patient must sign an informed consent form. The manufacturer must choose to provide the drug. The manufacturer may charge for the drug, so if the patient can't pay, they don't get it, so the patient doesn't actually have a right to anything. But that's by the by. And then two bits that are of interest. There is a bar on regulators taking disciplinary action against doctors who provide these drugs solely on the basis of providing the drug. So regulators are not allowed to commence fitness to practice proceedings against doctors who provide these drugs, no matter how bad the decision. Many states also remove at least some civil liability. The two federal bills, by the way, the Senate bill removes the right to sue in negligence, but not gross negligence. The House of Representatives bill removes the right to sue in negligence and gross negligence. In other words, you can't sue at all. And this is just a quote from the Goldwater template, basically saying regulators can't take action. So in the name of patient autonomy, patients are presented with a deal to be struck. If they have no other hope, they may, under certain circumstances, access these drugs that are recommended by the physician, but the decision is theirs, and they must therefore take responsibility for it. In theory, it is their values that are being prioritized rather than the values of the doctor. Therefore, the patient cannot sue the doctor, and the regulator, they cannot make a complaint to the regulator. In other words, they get access to the drugs, but the usual regulatory frameworks designed to protect them are removed from play. Many of you may well be slightly uncomfortable at this prospect. Some of you, on the other hand, might say, actually, you know, there's something to be said for this. Mary's going, nobody is thinking that. And of course, this would be bad enough in an ideal world, but there are several features that make right to try even worse. And that is basically the fact that patients are imperfect consumers, especially in this position. So, for example, this particular patient group is extremely vulnerable. They have no other hope, and it is very easy to convince them that they want something, or that they should want something, or that taking the treatment offered is a good idea. The fetishization of choice makes it far easier for patients to engage quacks, or perhaps, more precisely, it makes it far more difficult to avoid the overconfident, the reckless, those who are more like who want personal glory, etc., etc., etc. This is exacerbated by the fact that, for very specific reasons that I'm happy to answer questions on later but won't go into now, there is no requirement to report results. Adverse events do not have to be put in any kind of databases. And finally, Rebecca Dresser makes the wonderful point that all of the voices in terms of discourse around experimental treatments point towards situations where they worked, where the patient was cured, where they got better quality of life, where they got longer quality of life. Situations like in Boyd are downplayed and we don't tend to think of them. Essentially, patients are encouraged to think that the treatments that they are being offered is tomorrow's standard treatments given to them today. And they're encouraged to bypass fuddy-duddy regulations that are depriving them of the chance of a cure. And this is all dressed up in terms of prioritizing patient autonomy and giving effect to patient values. But we have to recognize that that's not what this is doing. What Right to Try does, through the doctor's gatekeeper role and through the distortion of the discourse, is actually strengthening the doctor's ability to impose her own values on the patient. I would argue that the provision of this treatment constitutes an application of conscience on the part of the doctor. And this makes this kind of statement by Lord Blencathra, during the Saatchi Bill debate, who, by the way, has multiple sclerosis, so he does have an interest here. He says, essentially, it's the last bit, this rat is willing to become a guinea pig at very, very short notice. He thinks he's applying his own values, but I would argue that he isn't. I know that I need to get on with this. So the Royal College of Paediatrics also commented on the Saatchi Bill and said this: the bill will encourage irresponsible experimentation. Families already at heightened susceptibility to the promise of miracle cures because of the illnesses of their children or loved ones will be prey to at worst quackery and at best to the possibly strongly held but inadequately justified convictions of medical practitioners who do not know how or do not wish to test treatments objectively. You will note that this doesn't so much make reference to clinical judgment and technical medical skill, but to recklessness. This idea of doctors who do not wish to test treatments objectively. So this isn't good. And the worrying part is that in the law more generally, this attitude is beginning to seep in. Look at these two quotes from what, for people who aren't English medical lawyers or Scottish medical lawyers, and why aren't you? These two quotes from probably the most landmark case in the last 10 years in medical law. These are from the Supreme Court, Lords Reed and Kerr. Patients are now widely regarded as persons holding rights rather than the passive recipients of the care of the medical profession. They are also widely treated as consumers exercising choices. a viewpoint which has underpinned some of the developments in the provision of healthcare services. Therefore, the social and legal developments point towards an approach to the law which, instead of treating patients as placing themselves in the hands of their doctors and then being prone to sue their doctors in the event of a disappointing outcome, treats them so far as possible as adults who are capable of understanding that medical treatment is uncertain of success and may involve risks, accepting responsibility for the taking of risks affecting their own lives, and living with the consequences of those choices. This sounds very much like the same bargain as right to try. You pays your money, you takes your choice, don't blame us. But what it ignores is the gatekeeping role that doctors have to take. If we accept that deciding to provide medical treatment beyond the standard involves value judgments that we may call a claim of conscience, then patient the prioritization of patient autonomy isn't actually limiting that. We have to accept that it's reinforcing those claims of conscience by essentially placing the patient in a marketplace and saying, you choose. The danger of right to try and the Medical Innovation Bill is that the protections against that, regulators and the law, were actively sabotaged by the bill. Reckless doctors, doctors who are overconfident, doctors who are after personal glory, doctors who want to benefit future patients at the expense of the patient that they are currently treating, are disempowered and left at the mercy of decisions made by these doctors. And so, since we're in Glasgow, I have to give a Sheila McLean quote, it's an old quote. She said, in relation to the old law, she said, no matter the quality of medicine practice, no matter the doubts of doctors themselves about the appropriateness of their involvement, human life is increasingly medicalized. In part, this is a result of growing professionalism of medicine, in part our responsibility for asking too much of doctors. In part, however, it's also because the buffer which might be expected to stand between medicalization and human rights, namely the law, has proved unwilling, unable, or inefficient when asked to adjudicate on or control issues which are at best tangentially medical. And I would ask, 20 years on, whether that actually still applies. And I would argue that certainly in the case of right to try, it does. So, we don't just want doctors to exercise conscience. We want them to exercise good conscience. And this will entail boundary setting by the law and professional regulators. The danger of this fetishization of autonomy is that it legitimizes all offers on the table, placing the patient in a marketplace, and ignores the gatekeeping role that doctors have, which then further feeds into their use of conscience. Right to try in the Medical Innovation Bill actively sabotage this oversight that used to be performed by the law and regulators, and allows poor exercises of conscience to flourish. And this is a final point. When we think about conscience, we think about issues that involve the use of conscience. But perhaps we shouldn't just look at it in terms of whether, let's say, is abortion an issue which involves the use of conscience? Of course it is. We also need to look at what, once we ascertain that there is an issue of conscience, what the boundaries of the decision making are. I feel that I've got some kind of model in my head, but I couldn't draw it. And if I could draw it, I certainly wouldn't be able to get it onto a slide. So I will shut up there.